Generosity is an act of faith that demonstrates that we trust God to keep his promises to us and to his work. Remember and celebrate the uniqueness of the generosity of South Maine, both for budgets and for capital needs. Together, when we are generous, we step into a life that trusts God to keep his promises and trusts him to accomplish his work within us. Specifically tonight, we're going to talk about legacy giving and the vehicles you can use to leave a permanent and lasting gift to the missions and ministry of South Maine. A little bit of recent history on some of our legacy giving efforts and why we're doing this. When we got about halfway through the Generations campaign that renovated the Sanctuary and Fellowship Hall, we started asking the question, you know, what would it take to endow the maintenance of the church with enough money so that we wouldn't really have to spend capital campaign dollars on things like deferred maintenance. Much of the Generations campaign was putting steel in the floor and things that you can't see, things that are behind the walls. And so we started talking about with the foundation about creating a fund at the foundation using the existing stuff there with a goal of $7 million. And that was upon some advice from some folks at Rice University, and that is that if you take the total replacement cost of your buildings, and in our case that's $70 million, you take 10% of that cost and endow it, that should throw off $350,000 a year, which is a good rule of thumb for how much you need to do better. So legacy giving started kind of percolating as a way to populate this fund. So the foundation launched a legacy giving effort. We've met over the course of the last couple of years with several different age groups. And each time we've done that, it's been really interesting. Some new folks have surfaced who have either changed their wills to leave the church in their will, or they've let us know, oh, I've had the church in our will all along. So we're sort of gathering that data. One of the challenges with a campaign like this is that you don't really know it's there unless you ask. People have to identify and be comfortable saying, yes, I've left the church in my will. And if they're not doing that, then you just kind of, you frankly have to wait until they're no longer here, and then you know that the money comes in. What's really interesting about this kind of giving, it's very different than your annual giving or anything else, because it's the opportunity for many people to leave the single largest gift they could ever leave to the church. Most of your net worth is in your house, or your long-term investments, things like that. Things that you don't just give on a regular basis. And you can imagine leaving 10% of all that you have at the end to the church, what an impact that would have for the next 100 years, right? The other 90% still goes to your heirs and any other beneficiaries you have. But if 10%, if a tithe of your assets were to go to the church, it has a really, really huge impact. It's a unique kind of commitment in that it's... For lack of a better term, it's no money down, right? I mean, it's you're thinking ahead and thinking, what can I leave behind? And so really what we're talking about is stepping into this decades-long tradition at South Maine of incredible generosity. So the folks in 1925 who looked at building the sanctuary, and by the way, I looked this up, the cost to build the sanctuary in 1925 was $193,000, right? $193,000 to build the sanctuary in 1925. But that was a lot of money back then. That was a very generous congregation who did that. In the 1960s, to build the chapel, to build the Chafin building. In 2009, to renovate this room and the space that we were in. That was a generation of folks who stepped into that. And then for many of us in this room, just 3 years ago, made a commitment to renovating the Sanctuary and Fellowship Hall and positioning the church in a good place for the next 100 years. As we were talking about the next 100 years and talking about the need for this fund, it occurred to us that we had an opportunity to honor a legacy of someone who loved this campus and transformed this campus, and that's my predecessor, Tom Williams. So Tom was here for 15 years and actually retired right before we started the Generations campaign. And so we went through a process, and the foundation established and the congregation voted on the Thomas J. Williams 100-Year Fund. Tom's marks are all over the campus. Did you know that there used to be organ pipes in front of the stained glass in the chapel? They used to cover the stained glass, and so just little things like that moved them to the side. In welcoming folks, in our work around the campus, just the beautiful landscaping, all of these are things that when Tom got here weren't in place. creativity. I think these guys are gone now, but they were there for a while. And so we started asking the question, how do we really care for the campus into the next century? So, backing up just a little bit, what is the foundation itself? The foundation is an endowment that we have. It is an integrated auxiliary, technically, of South Main Baptist Church, with about $5 million. And half of that is undesignated funds. The other are some designated buckets for various missions and ministries. And there was, at the time we were looking at this, a small amount designated for capital maintenance. What does the foundation support? The Next Wave capital campaign, which was this building, the children's space, the Loesner building windows, big capital projects like this. The foundation was the single largest donor to the Generations capital campaign. But the foundation also supports things like Operación San Andrés, Sozo International, the Midtown Music Concert Series that we've now in the second season of. All of those things are made possible by the foundation. What supports the foundation? Two things: designated gifts and undesignated bequests, which used to fall into two categories. So if you would leave the church in your will or estate, the church gets a portion of that, the foundation gets the bulk of it, and it used to go 50% to missions and ministries and 50% to capital maintenance. When we established the Tom Williams Fund, we voted to change that allocation so that we could accelerate the contributions going into the Tom Williams Fund. And so we did that. The goal is $7 million, and there's still two buckets, but until it gets to that $7 million, 25% goes to missions and ministries, and 75% goes into the Tom Williams Fund. All of that is to say that if you have the church in your will already, and it's an undesignated bequest, or if you're thinking about doing it, this is where it goes, and this is how it gets spent. All right, Mike.
You might have just said this, and I might have missed it, but the initial goal is $7 million, and what is the current corpus?
The corpus of the foundation is $5 million. There's about $1 million, Bob, is that safe to say, in the Tom Williams Fund?
Yes, but only about $500,000 of that is our actually investable assets, but that's going to change when we sell the Coles, Sarah and Paul Coles' house that was left to us, and we should be another $300,000. So it's in the total now, but it's not really anything. Assets we can do anything with until we sell it, turn it into cash.
So we've been doing this effort for a little more than a year, and to already have $500,000 in assets and then plus these properties that are there as well that will come to the foundation, I think is great progress toward this goal. All right. That's enough of that. Okay, so we're here to talk specifically about wills. I want to introduce Bob Fowler, who is the past president of the foundation board and is currently a director of the foundation board. Bob is also an attorney and has walked several families through legacy gifts over the years over his time at South Main. And Crystal Wheeler, who works for the Methodist
Foundation. Texas Methodist Foundation.
Yeah, the Texas Methodist Foundation. And is one who has identified, she and Brandon have left the church in their will. Brandon and Crystal actually spoke at our last legacy giving luncheon in the fall and did a great job there. So we're just going to kind of jump right in. Bob, you're up. You want to stay there or come up here?
I'll come up there.
Bob, I've heard you say that everyone has an estate. If you own something, you have an estate. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And so if we have an estate, you have two choices. One is you decide what happens to your estate when you're gone. And if you don't, who does?
If you don't, the state of Texas does. You have to forgive my voice. I've got allergies. relatively unknown in Houston. You've heard it said before that if you don't have a will, that the state will make one for you, and I'm here to show you that they do that in 496 pages of laws known as the Texas Estates Code. They're not all about wills, but they are about things, some of which we'll talk about. A lot of it is about what is called dying intestate, which means that you didn't leave a will. So, I think if you don't have a will, before this is over, I'll try to give you some good reasons that you may want to consider a will, or that you should have one. The legislature tends to think about things in terms of one size fits all, and even within this room, you know that that's not the case. But it's hard to put a million different, or in Texas, 25 million different plans together in a code, so they try to get everything that gets sweeps in the most number of people. And like most legislative efforts, the job is not always very satisfying to either the legislators or to the population. But we do have some really good probate laws in the state of Texas, and it's you can take advantage of them through your will, and even the estate's code supports you in doing that. Let me give you a couple of examples of things that you might not want to happen if you don't have a will. Let's say that one of you husbands in this room and your wife are living in an apartment, saving the down payment for your first home. Most of you are a little bit beyond that, and some well beyond that. But suddenly, the husband's crazy uncle dies and leaves the husband his $2 million house in Westview. So the parents, the husband and wife, who, for our example, have two minor children, decide that this is a wonderful place to live. They throw a huge party and spend all their down payments celebrating their recent wealth. Actually, it's the husband's under the law because he inherited it. And so they take what's left of the down payment money after the party and buy furniture for the house that more suits them rather than crazy uncle, and they move in there. Unfortunately, because of one thing or another, a reason or another, the husband dies in the first year, very tragically, and suddenly there's the issue of who owns the house. There's no will, so this little book says, since it was a husband's separate property, that the wife is going to get the right to live in the house, and she would as a homestead anyway, but as her ownership, she has none. She has a life estate in 1/3 of the value of the house. The two minor children have the remainder interest in the 1/3, and then they share outright the 2/3, the rest of the house's ownership. The wife has no legal ownership, only the right to live in the house until she dies or abandons it. And so the wife wants to get control of what the children cannot do as minors, and that is manage real estate or anything else they inherited from their husband, from her husband and their father. So she goes to the probate court and says, my kids can't manage this house nor some other assets that my husband's non-will left to them. So what can I do? And she has to hire an attorney for much more than she would pay to have had a simple will done. And that attorney will get a petition to have a guardianship court-supervised, appointed separately for each of the two children, and the court will then look at any substantive financial decisions, and she will have to bring a motion to the court until those children reach their majority to do and take any substantive actions with respect to what they owned through inheriting property from their father when he thought all along it would go to their mother. So this is two areas that this book gets you involved that you probably don't want to be involved and can generally avoid with a simple will. Interestingly, she is the guardian of the two children because she is the mother, and this is not a court-appointed guardianship. It is the guardianship of the persons, but not of their estates. And so that's a different kind of thing, but she still gets to be their mother and tell them what to do, but she has to ask the court's permission to deal with their with the money that they have. Now, certainly she doesn't have to go in every week and say, I need to buy them school clothes, I need a court order for that, but anything substantive. And there are relaxed rules for family guardianships, but they're still tough. I have been a guardian of somebody, and she was not related, and we had to put up a bond, and we had to go to the court, and I asked the court's permission to take her assets and invest them in stocks, and the probate judge's response was, I don't know anything about stocks. If I were to let you buy stocks, then I would get blamed if you lost money, so you may not buy stocks. You may put it in a savings account, a passbook account, if you would. She passed away fairly quickly because she was old and very much incapacitated, and so that was a blessing for a variety of reasons, particularly to her, I think, but so we didn't have to deal with that so long. On the other hand, if you had a simple will that said, husbands, everything went to your wife, and wife, everything went to your husband, then you would only go to court one time to have the will admitted to probate, and you would be typically sworn in as the executor of the estate, and then you would be off and running. And the court would have no jurisdiction other than to eventually close the estate, and you wouldn't even have to go back there for that. But the Dolores asked me, and this is very important to touch on other than the financial aspect, and that is that in your will, you can designate who you prefer would raise your children if both of you are gone. And this is extraordinarily important. Further, you can leave in the event that your spouse does not survive you or does not survive you. No, that's right. Does not survive you. You can leave your assets in trust for your minor children. And trust, you get to choose the trustee and name that person in your will. And the trustee doesn't have to go to court. The court is out of the deal. So there is, being a trustee in a will-provided trust is so much simpler than being a guardian in a court-appointed guardianship, and much cheaper. Because, unfortunately, when you get lawyers and courts involved, there tend to be fees involved. And though I'm not, as a matter of fact, opposed to lawyers earning fees, these are somewhat unnecessary fees. Now, what would happen if you died intestate, that is without a will, and you had minor children, and then the worst tragedy happened and the other spouse died? Well, you go back to good old probate court again, and the probate court makes a decision based on all the evidence of what it believes is in the best interest of the child. Suppose you had a close blood relative that you did not particularly want to raise your children. Let's say it's a sibling. And the court said, well, you have this deceased person and this other deceased person's sister-in-law is really a nice person with a nice family, and we're going to say that it's in the best interest of the children that this person raised those children. Of course, that person has to agree to it. So you could avoid that by naming the guardian of your children in that event in a will. Let's say, too, that you have a relative that's close to you by blood. And you think they would be great, that person would be great in raising your children, but he or she has a terrible problem with money, tends to spend every dime that gets his hand on. And so the court said, well, there's this really nice person, and we're going to give her or him the right to raise these children. Neither you nor your spouse are there to object, but if you had named that person as the guardian of their person in your will and named another brother-in-law or sister-in-law who had a different attitude about money as the trustee in the trust that were established, then you would have both sides covered. So there are a lot of considerations, but probably what happens to your children are much more important than any of the financial parts. So that's the great thing about putting that in a simple will. I say a simple will because that's the first step. When your kids are no longer minors, you're probably going to change your will. And over the years, if you have the opportunity to do something like Brad has talked about, then you'll be amazed at how your priorities change the older you get. And I know I don't need to tell you all that, even at this age. Anyway, you can put whatever you want in the will that's appropriate. The court is going to question it if you put in there that you want your children to be raised by a Maharishi in a cult in Pakistan or someplace. But
don't do that.
That would be up to somebody else to challenge it. Are you going to ask me some more questions?
I am going to ask you some more questions.
Okay. Well, I don't.
So you keep using the phrase "simple will."
Yes.
Right? And it sounds more complicated than just a simple will, but.
Just do it.
Yeah, right. If someone doesn't have a will, you know, do you need a lawyer? How much does it cost? How do you get past that first initial step?
Well,
because there's LegalZoom, there are things. I mean, there's web resources out there.
Absolutely. In fact, I was going to say that I don't do wills, but I do some wills, but I'm not going to do your wills because I don't want to do wills that involve children. Not because I dislike children. I'm a real estate lawyer, and Dale Johnson, who walked in there, is somebody that I've been talking with for some period of time, and I won't embarrass you any more than I already have to, Dale. But I may be drawing a new will for him, or I may not be. But I'm capable of doing it. But I'm not selling that tonight. A simple will simply means that you don't give too much complication in the drafting as to if this happens, I want that. If this happens, I want this. If my cousin has been good to me, to my mother, I want somebody to determine that. Then I'm going to leave him or her $15,000. If you get too complicated, it increases the drafting. And so from a lawyer standpoint, it might increase the fee. But generally, where does my money go when I die, and who takes care of my children, and setting up trust, and trust in a will simply says, I give my money in trust to my minor children until their age, put whatever you want, 20, 25, 65 if you want to, and I appoint so-and-so as the trustee, or name so-and-so as the trustee, and if so-and-so won't serve, then I say it'll be this other person, and you put as much, but there's no reason to put 13 people in there. Eventually, somebody will stick. And the good news is it's highly unlikely, one, that one of you will die while your children are minor, but certainly that both of you will, but it happens all the time, so it's a good thing to cover. So I'd say that a simple will would be probably 4 or 5 pages of provisions, a lot of which are boilerplate, and a lawyer you're going to need two wills if you're married, and they're going to be very closely aligned to one another. And probably for two wills, you'd pay around $1,000. If you don't want to pay a lawyer, and I urge you to do that, since you wouldn't be paying me, you just need to be very, very sure of what you're doing. And LegalZoom has a decent product, there's no doubt about it, and it's available for Texas. And you need to be sure that you don't need somebody there who's going to say, have you ever thought about this since you put that there? And a questionnaire on a website is not likely to ask you those kind of questions. It will say, who do you want to be guardian of your children, first choice, second choice? What are their, where are they, and what's their address? You can put in a will something different. You could, a lawyer might say, and you're not dumb, you might say the same thing, since your sister is married to a man who is 35 years older than she is, that you might want to reconsider that setting for those people. A lawyer will ask that question, but you'll ask yourself the same kind of questions. I just think that that money is a good price for peace of mind. You can find lawyers who will do two wills for less than that, and certainly ones they will do for more. Fortunately, all of those pages and pages of tax-driven considerations are not necessary under the current environment. Between the two of you, you can now have an estate of up to $22 million. I'm sure that will change before you get up to $22 million. It may go back down to $2 million, and then you have to think about the more complicated wills at some point. But right now, you don't have to deal with that.
If your estate is worth $22 million, I would strongly encourage you, considering leaving the church.
Just 10% is just fine.
Yeah, if it's worth two, I would strongly
encourage. One other thing real quick that you're going to put in a tax will, and those of you who have wills have experiences, is called a self-proving affidavit. That's where you get two witnesses and a notary, and you basically tell one another, you as the testator, that you are, this is your will and you're signing it, and I want you to witness it. And they say, then they say, they asked me that, this person asked me that, and I witnessed it, and I said I would. And then you all swear before a notary that you've done that. The will is then self-proven, which means when you die and it's submitted to probate, which is not a difficult process in Texas, nor is it an expensive one, but a probate without a will can be very expensive because the court gets involved in supervising it, and it's going to be much more expensive ultimately to you. But anyway, when you have a self-proving affidavit, which then you can establish with an independent executor that that person, that that will is proven, considered valid without the appearance of the witnesses. If you mess that up, and you'll get the one you get with LegalZoom, which is just as good as any, but if the signing ceremony will take place in the lawyer's office, he or she will get two employees to be your witnesses. You don't have to know them. He or she will get the notary. It may be the lawyer himself or herself. And you know that that's done right. If you mess it up, then like you got somebody that maybe is in the will, and they'll warn you in LegalZoom not to do this, that might be a beneficiary under the will, then that would invalidate them as a witness. So you go through a lot of hassle. I think it's a good investment at that price, and so I would recommend it, but you can do it yourself.
Crystal, tell us a little bit, but first share a little bit about what led you and Brandon to leave the church and your will.
So I work for the Methodist Foundation that manages money and endowments and long-term charitable gifts for Methodist churches. And so for the last 12 years, I've known I've been learning and becoming educated and well-versed in charitable giving and wills and estate planning and all of those things much more than I might otherwise at 25 or 30 years old. And the biggest thing that caught my attention when I started working there is that, I mean, well, two things. One, obviously, you can't take anything with you when you go. So, you know, you spend your whole life earning and saving and earning and building all this, you know, wealth, hopefully in theory. And then you die and it has to go somewhere. And there are only three places it can go. It can go to the government, it can go to your family, or it can go to charity. That's it. Like, and so if you don't want all of your money or even pay unto Caesar what is his, but if you don't want to pay the government more than what they are owed, and maybe your family is either already well taken care of or, you know, take care of your family with your will too, charity is the other bucket that you can choose. And there are millions of charities all over the world you can choose. When Brandon and I started doing our will, it was because I had gotten pregnant with Owen, and we decided that was it was time to do that because we had a child involved. And we spent a lot of time talking about powers of attorney and healthcare directives and, you know, DNR issues and all these things. But when it came to which charities do we want to support with, you know, the residual of our estate after we've paid all of our fees and given our kid whatever we think he needs, where's the rest of it going to go? And it was really a no-brainer because we love South Main so much. It's just like, this is where the best ministry is happening that we can see. And I've seen a lot of ministries, and there are a lot of nonprofit charities that could use support. A lot of people, I mean, I've seen wills that split up the beneficiary list 20 different ways. I don't advise that. It's a nightmare for people trying to execute it, but you can. Steve Wells has talked about tithing, or not tithing your will, which is what Bob talked about, but treating the church as an additional child. He said he has three children, and he treats the church as his fourth child. So when he and Missy pass away, 25% of their estate will come to the church. So that's another way to do it. Definitely promote percentages over actual numbers, because you have no idea what your estate can do over the next 20 years or 50 years or however long you're here. But
when
we decided
when y'all went to sit down with the lawyer for the first time, did you have to know all that going in, or did they walk you through that?
Well, I was fortunate a little bit because I helped develop for the foundation where I work a 48-page wills guide that basically walks you through.
That's better than 476 right. pages.
Well, 48 pages was still the largest will. I mean, they had 8-page versions, and we decided the bigger one was better. But we had basically a presentation we were doing for churches that there's a book, and it if you read a chapter of the book, it pushes you online to the online wills planner. You answer the questions, you read the next chapter, you answer the questions. By the time you finish the book, you finish the wills guide. And basically, you can take the wills guide to your lawyer and say, here are all the answers to all the questions to get us started. And it's basically, who's in your family and what are your assets and what are you, you know, ages and medical issues and all of your, it's 48 pages of what you want to happen. And it's not a legally binding document, but then you take that to a lawyer and they can translate that into a will, which would take a lot less time. I imagine if you have a good lawyer, it would be slightly less expensive if they already have all the information that you could just hand to them. So I had Will's guide that I went through, and we kind of, I mean, just from drafting it and troubleshooting it for other people, I kind of knew which pieces to look at and what to do there. But the biggest piece was find the charity that's going to do the most good and make the most impact with your money. And this is where we've chosen to put down roots, and we've invested our time and our, you know, all the rest of the facets of stewardship into this church. So it seems like the logical next step.
So we've talked a little bit about, you know, just get a will, obviously. Step one is, where do you want your money to go? Who do you want to take care of your children? All those kind of things. What are some other special provisions? I've heard, you know, there's a lot of people talk about a no survivors provision. So if for some horrible reason your entire family is killed, what do you need to do, and how do you establish that so that you have a plan for your estate even when there's not necessarily anybody to inherit it?
Right.
Well, you'd write it in there. I mean,
you
need to have some ultimate provision. I real quickly, I have alluded to this in some of our presentations, that if you have in your will that if no one on earth is kin to me when I die, which is impossible, then I leave everything, and I leave everything to the church. Well, that's a little bit, it's not a bad thing in your first will to put in there, but it's probably not likely to happen. But it's not a bad stepping stone in a simple will to start with that, and knowing that it's highly unlikely. And then as your estate gets more, gets bigger and more complicated, and you really are to the point where you say to your spouse, if you have a spouse, we've taken care of the kids' college, et cetera, we've paid for weddings, or we don't have any kids, we need to think seriously about alternatives for this, since we all have a lot of cousins, but some of which we used to like, and some of which we were particularly close to, but we don't know where they are anymore, and some of which we really like, and we'll leave her $10,000 and him $25,000, but then all the rest, we've got a lot of flexibility on. But those kind of things certainly can enter in.
Well, and you brought up a good point. It's definitely, you should definitely have multiple contingencies, if-thens, like if this person refuses, you know, this person can take over, whether it's guardianship or executor. Something else I would encourage that we sometimes encourage is a lot of people, when it comes to choosing an executor, will choose, you know, someone in their family that they trust. Well, that person may know nothing about the law, and you've basically just given them the biggest headache of their lives. So I'm just saying, like, if you're going to do the forethought and the planning to put a will together, put something in there. Or if you're going to save to prepay for your funeral expenses or your burial or cremation process, put something in there. Consider putting something in there that authorizes someone to appoint a lawyer or someone who knows what they're doing to take care of that for you, so that you don't have to do it yourself or whoever you think might be that person.
And along those same lines, don't put anybody except as a beneficiary in your will to have a duty unless you ask them if they're willing to do it.
That's true, too. Yes.
Surprise.
Surprise. You're going to watch your kids for the next 17 years.
In an Oklahoma will, and I lived here, but it was fortunately something I could handle. But you particularly don't leave your children to somebody if they
without
don't
asking
know
first.
That's
good advice. What questions do y'all have for Bob or for Crystal? Thoughts, questions.
How often should you edit? You know, is it, because it sounds like it's can be kind of fairly expensive.
Great,
is editing a will the same price as creating a will?
Well, if you're speaking of codicils, I think you'll spend less on doing that.
What's a codicil?
A codicil. A codicil is an edict.
Just nod and smile. Ah, yes, codicil.
A codicil is an amendment of a will. And it's often just one
paragraph,
because you've had one section, someone's died, or you don't like them anymore, or you want to add your church or your foundation or some other charity. It's done with the same solemnity and formality, but it doesn't, it's not nearly the drafting. It just says paragraph 3A will now read so-and-so, and the other one is removed. And you don't have to do it very often. You got a will that's going to last you 10 to 20 years until your circumstances change, and it may last your whole life, and your life may not last that long. That's why you have a will. But I don't think there's an often date time.
So the research we've done at the foundation I work for says that in general, people should at least review their will to make sure that it's up to date every 3 to 5 years. But that time frame, I think, is for an older population. If you're over 50, say, or over 60, you should probably every 5 years take a look at your will. But most people in reality, I think, only actually maybe change their will up to 3 times in their lifetime. So So it's like they'll create a will when they first get married or first have a baby or first get a real asset in their estate. And then maybe they have a grandchild or they get divorced or some other life event happens 15 or 20 years later. They update the will, and then maybe in their 70s or 80s they start thinking about their mortality and they'll update it a final time. So I think in practice, a handful of times over your lifetime is all you'll really update it, but you should definitely not only review it every 3 to 5 years, but you should tell people where it is and give a copy of your will to someone other than your spouse who may not be in their right mind to find it when it's time. So just keep that in mind too.
Speaking as a spouse that's not always in his right mind. The good news in Texas and most places, if you lose your original will, you can prove up a copy of it. But it's a good idea not to lose it. The courts are really impressed when it's original signatures and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I think one of the things I'd like to take away, I gave you a bunch of examples. Those are the bad things if you don't have a will. So it can still be... you can still cover a lot by getting a will tomorrow that just covers those three or four things. Even if all you did was call the people and say, "Will you take care of my kids? I've always loved you. Your kids are great, blah, blah, blah." And they say yes, and you do that tomorrow, you've got a will in place so you don't have to worry about these laws. And then I'm not saying do it in a hurry, but still... you can't plan your life, to answer your question, and all contingencies, although it can work out that way, but you can do a will and just have it for 20 years until your kids are through and through off your bank roll, which happens more rarely now.
I would also say that...
I'm just looking around. I'm supposed to make eye contact.
So Bob has talked about a couple of examples of what happens in the bad world if you don't have a will. I also want to urge you to make sure you do cross all your T's and dot all your I's and pay the money for the lawyer to do it, because even if you have a will, I've seen more cases than I care to talk about where the person had a will, you know, they laid it out, this goes to family, this goes to charity, and then... you know, nieces and nephews will come out of the woodworks and say, they weren't in their right mind, and I'm suing all of the things in the will to see. And money just drains out of the account because lawyers and judges have to go through and decide if the will is valid and if they were in their right mind. And so if you can get the dual signature with the notary and have a lawyer, I mean, I think, I don't want to say this too loudly, but in Texas they do still accept holographic wills, which just means handwritten. You can handwrite your own will. I do not recommend it. I've seen those come through, and they end up in court because they don't believe that it's a valid will, or the lady changed her mind the week before she died and rewrote something else to attach to her will, and it can get really messy and very ugly.
Because if you had page numbers that were typed on 1, 2, 3, and you wrote all the rest of it, it's not a holographic will.
Right.
So it has to be 100%. Don't do that.
Yeah, just skip it. I'm just saying somebody might tell you, you can just handwrite it, but don't do that.
What other questions?
Do you have a recommendation for somebody to go to?
I'd be happy to share one with you. Not, I mean it private. I don't want to advertise. It won't be me. But I do.
Yeah, but if you do need, yeah, he's done that for a lot of folks, so he can recommend and point you to somebody who can help.
Or email me. But there are lots of people that can do a good will for you.
Is there a way to avoid probate?
Well, there is, but as I alluded to, it's not something that you're going to spend what's left is going to spend very much money on. Now, if you have nothing, if you had everything, like if you had 100% of what you have taken care of, let's say you just had only IRAs and you rented an apartment, and the IRA's beneficiaries are completely separate, they don't go through probate. probate, they're not part of your will. This is just an example. And then you had a car that wasn't worth selling, and then you had personal property. I say car because it has a title. And you tell your brother and sister that when you're gone, come down and get and split up whatever you want because it's not worth anything anyway. What you're going to get is coming through the IRA. Then you don't have to have a probate. But a probate is going to be typically in a $1,000 range, kind of a thing, too. I don't want to quote too many people's fees, but it's not a difficult process. You can do a living trust. Those things are oversold in Texas. They're quite expensive, and there's no tax advantage to them because there's not really a tax issue, and there wasn't much of a tax advantage anyway. But my aunt in California died in 1980. She had a major bank's lawyer draw her, do everything. She was a widow, and she had a reasonably good estate at that time. They left out one mineral interest on 1 acre in Oklahoma where she was from, so she had to, the trust took care of all of 98% of her assets, but she had to do an ancillary probate in Oklahoma court. She wasn't doing it, but her trustee did, to split that into 26 shares or something like that, and that was about $2,000 or $2,500 in 1980 dollars, so it's going to be $10,000-$20,000 now. So if you have that, Dale, you'd want to be sure everything that's titled is in there. And we don't see them very often. Some people use them to buy houses and so forth, and they're just not real popular because the probate is very simple here. I had one other thought about it, but I can't remember what it was. But it supported my premise.
It was a good
my thesis. It was a good idea. Just take me word. Oh, you no longer have to have, if all the beneficiaries are given an accounting of what your estate is under Texas law now, it is no longer part of the record. So your will be shown there, but if you have $10 million worth of assets and all it says is a fourth I leave to so-and-so and $10,000 here, there, and you don't care about that being public knowledge, not that people go into the probate records and look things up, but they do sometimes, the accounting, which the court requires, no longer has to be public as long as all the beneficiaries receive a copy of it. So you no longer have to avoid probate to keep people from knowing how much money you left.
In the few minutes we have left, Crystal, you alluded to something earlier about, for you and Brandon, this was the place to plant roots and settle down. Why South Maine?
Well, I spent a long time looking for a church. I grew up Southern Baptist. I was Lutheran for a little bit, non-denominational for a little bit. I work for the Methodists. I've looked around. I've toured churches. And when Brandon and I started dating, we started going to St. Paul's Methodist down the street. And it was a fine church. I love what they do there, but it was just not the right fit. And there were some other issues, but we needed a new church home. And my boss, who's actually Methodist clergy, after I told him what I wanted, which was traditional music from my Southern Baptist roots without the Southern Baptist conservative theology. Something a little bit more, like, still traditional, still good, but like, and he was like, that sounds a lot like South Maine. And so we came once and we never looked back. And now I think 7 or 8 of my family members have also joined.
Yeah,
so they've followed us here.
Okay.
What's awesome about all of it is that when we joined, we really weren't even planning to have kids. Like, we had already changed our mind and said, so we didn't even look at the children's ministry. We didn't even look at a bunch of things around here. We looked at the couple of things that we cared about. And then a month after we joined, I found out I was pregnant. So we're like, oh, maybe we should look into the children's ministry. And conveniently, it's an amazing space as well. So.
Bob, for you and Anne, this was a few more years ago than maybe for Crystal and Brandon, but what was it that made South Main feel like home and made this feel like a place where you wanted to invest your life?
Well, I think initially it was because it was a church like I was used to, but now I don't even think about the church I grew up in as my church at all. And I've been a member here. I was a member before Ann and I married since 1968. We were gone for 3 or 4 years, but then we were right back here. And it's a good fit for us. It's a perfect church in many ways and an imperfect church in many ways, but the perfects outweigh the imperfects. And but the best thing about this church, other than it being a wonderful place to worship God and study, is the community here. And second to it in these ancillary things is the fact that there's really not too many people here with an agenda. In fact, my wife has recently tells me, and quite often, that we don't have to take a stand on everything and have an opinion on everything that's going on that you people should make decisions. So Brad will tell you that I'm not very good at holding back on some of that, but I try not to be as public. I just work behind the scenes.
Yeah. That's okay. Well, I thank you both for being here. Part of why, we ask you to do this is you both represent two different generations in this church, but really similar generations. And I think it's a testament to your faith and your trust in what God is doing at the church and what God is doing in your life to determine that this is the place where you want to plant roots and to make a significant decision. You know, I said earlier it's kind of a no money down decision to leave a legacy gift, but the reality is it's no less significant than anything else that would go in your will and in your estate plan. So
I always say it's the easiest check you'll ever write.
Yep.
Because it doesn't hurt at all to let go of that money.
Thanks. And thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.